Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk and part two of a conversation with Charisse Beach, who holds a Master's of Arts degree in Educational Administration, a BA in English, a minor in Psychology, a teaching certificate in secondary education. These are all very critical to the story that you will hear from her today. Charisse Beach, welcome back to this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you.
And Charisse, you are, in addition to all of that education that I identified, you are an educator, you are an author, you have written a book entitled At-Risk Students, Transforming Student Behavior, which we will talk about for just a moment. But when we left the previous conversation with you, you were talking to us about Oliver. So just give a mini recap, if you can, of that day and that experience with your son, Oliver, your younger son, Oliver.
Okay, correct. At the time, he was 19, and this was August of 2007. So just to recap for any listeners just now joining us, I was going over some details of my youngest son's bipolar disorder diagnosis and the contradictions in some of the treatment plans, which led to some uneven successes on him getting the appropriate treatment, which ultimately led to him having a psychotic break and critically injuring me with a violent attack that was just unbelievable. I don't want to get too graphic because everybody can't take it, but it was very, very horrific. People who came to visit me the next day when I was in ICU said they did not even recognize me. And as horrific as that beating was, what is even more unbelievable is how my body healed. I was discharged from the hospital under 10 days.
That's extraordinary, because we do need to go back just for a moment. You were beaten unmercifully by your son with a 2x4.
It started with a 2x4, but from the 2x4, he would get tired of hitting me with the 2x4, and then he got a knife. And the knife, he stabbed me several times in my chest and stomach area, and then slit my throat from ear to ear. Then he got tired of that, and he went and got a hammer and started beating me in the head, and then beating me in the head with the head of the hammer that you would use to nail, and then take the other side of the hammer, which you would use to pull the nail out. He started pulling out my hair. And then he came to me at one point. It was like he was having the energy in him was unbelievable. It was uncanny. And he kept trying new things. So when he came with the cup of bleach and said, and he would still refer to me as Mom. Mom, drink this. And I'm like, what is that? Bleach. I'm like, nope, not drinking bleach. Nope, you'll just have to continue doing what you're doing, but I will not drink bleach. And throughout it all, I would try to say, you know, whatever you think I said, you got it wrong. I didn't. And then finally, after I wouldn't drink the bleach, and it's just unbelievable how he would say, he just did the whole, okay, like, no problem. You don't want to drink the bleach? You don't have to drink the bleach. So that just, all of that just speaks to how off the behavior is and how disconnected he was with what he was doing. So I started, you know, realizing that I'm definitely losing ground at that point. I'm very weak, very overcome, and I'm a pretty small woman by stature. So, again, that was all of that energy that I had came from my will to fight to live, whereas all of the energy he had came from his psychotic break. So I guess we were paralleled in our levels of energy. So I was able to say to him to go get the car and leave, because you're going to get caught. There's no way that my girlfriend Cheryl is not going to get the police here when she's talking to me and the phone flies across the driveway. And, you know, I just knew that something would happen. And he saw that to be a reality, so he did. He left out of the basement, and I assume, well, I learned later, he started gathering all of the weapons that he had used and put them in, wrapped them in a towel and put them in my car, and he had my purse in the car, and he was, I guess, going to head on. And that stopped because the police did show up.
Charisse, and, I have to interrupt you because this is a breathtaking story. This is, and perhaps what's the most breathtaking about it is that this really happened to you at the hands of your son. It is a complete miracle that you are alive today and able to talk about it. I mean, it brings tears to one's eyes just hearing of what you went through.
I guess because, Pam, you're absolutely correct, because those that were in my life to witness it, and then since then, those along the way that have heard it have the same reaction that you just expressed. But for me, because I was the only one present from the beginning to now, I've been able to process it to the point, as what I said a few minutes ago, that wasn't my Oliver. That was the disease. And I think we too often don't get that. And when I get into the next part, I'm going to follow whatever lead, because I do want to talk a little bit about what happened to Oliver after that day. After that day, and that will kind of explain some of why I can talk about this and not tear up.
Well, at some point, Oliver did leave, and...
No, he never had a chance to. He attempted,
okay,
but the police came to the house, and he was here. And he... I can't remember exactly what the police said, you know, of course I wasn't able to know anything at that point, but what I learned later was that they found his behavior to be suspicious, and they saw drops of blood from outside leading inside. So of course that right there is a red flag. And I don't remember how the officer ended up in the basement. I do know, because there was a little trail of blood that led to the door where my basement is, and so they followed that trail.
Okay.
And I just remember sitting in this unfinished room on this concrete floor with all kinds of nails and dirt and debris everywhere, and I'm just sitting there. I'm assuming I was a bloody mess. And when I remember looking up in this officer's face, and that's the last thing I saw until I woke up the next day or whenever in ICU. It was like I held on until I knew I had help. Because I don't remember getting in the ambulance, being transported to the hospital. I don't remember anything.
And when you woke up in ICU, who was there with you?
Family, neighbors. And that was probably it. A couple of my staff members were trying to get in. I understand that the hospital waiting room was unbelievable with people, but they actually closed the school down that day because the staff wasn't able to carry on. And I just remember just the outpouring of love. And days after that, the flowers, it was like, my room looked like a florist. It was flowers coming from people. I didn't even know who they were. And I'll tell anybody, the miracles I have witnessed before that are miracles that I witnessed. But this one definitely speaks to the power of prayer. From people you don't know, friends of friends, family of friends, who just may have said a word of, oh, I hope she gets better, or I'm praying for her. That has to make a huge difference, because following back to what I said, I was discharged, I think it was 8 days later. My doctor was amazed. He's like, I have never seen wounds like yours heal this quickly. It was not that after the surgery he thought I was going to be fine. It was definitely, I was considered in critical condition. But I never felt critical. I just felt like I'm going to be okay. But to heal that fast, he was like, I don't even have a reason to keep you. And I was like, well, thank you, because I am ready to go home.
You know, just the fact that you survived, quite frankly, any of what you went through is extra. I mean, we keep using the word miracle. I don't know what larger word to use, because with the beating that you described and the injuries that you described, it's a miracle that you're alive, period.
I agree, Pam, and with the understanding of how miracles work and how they come about, and my belief and faith in God, I know that he did not have me to survive to spread the word of hate and unconformity to mental illness and the effects that it has on everybody.
What happened to Oliver?
Oliver was arrested that fateful evening and charged with attempted murder. His dad and my oldest son, Robert, obviously had to deal with this. My mom was not in any condition. She was in early Alzheimer's stage, and her health was a little challenging at that point. So my son and Oliver's dad had to pretty much do double duty. Like, they had to be at the courthouse and be at the arraignment and meet with public defenders and then come to the hospital and check on me and deal with me and try to comfort my mother, who in her fluent mind days would just be a basket case crying because, you know, her baby was hurt. And then Oliver was my mom's namesake. Her name was Ollie, so we named Oliver after her. So she's feeling obviously like a double pain. So he stays in jail for a while, which I guess is anywhere is the same thing until you he's in like the regular jail. And actually, that was for a year he was in the regular jail. And when I was able to walk and drive, which was probably a month after all of this, even though I was discharged early, it definitely took time before I could resume, you know, normal activity.
Sure.
So I remember going to the jail to see him and to see the look on his face when he saw me, because I probably didn't look as bad as I did in ICU, but I definitely was not looking like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, I remember him breaking down inside the cage when he saw me. And then I went to go to see him again, like that next week or something. And that's when I got the reality check that I was not able to see him anymore because I was the victim. And I knew nothing about this part of society because I didn't have any legal involvement that would make me know about jail or prison and courtrooms and things like that. So I couldn't understand that, and I just kept approaching it from, but, you know, I'm his mother. What do you mean? Ma'am, you are the victim. We cannot have you seeing him. So I was like, okay. So the only time I could see him was for that year-long going to court, because it was never really a trial. There was no reason to have a so-called trial because he did do it.
Okay.
But I was told by the public defender to rest assured he would end up in a mental hospital for a placement and for therapy, and basically that's where he would be until he would be until it would be determined that he would be safe to either go into a step-down process or whatever the next step would be for him. And that was exactly what we as a family wanted for him and believed would be best for him. And shortly after a couple of months, the public defender's story completely changed. She became certain that he is not going to be going to a hospital. He's going to do prison time. And I wasn't totally discouraged with that either, because I'm thinking, well, you know, prison sometimes can be a healer if it's done in the in a therapeutic, with a therapeutic component. And yeah, he could use confinement. There's been some issues leading up to this that, you know, I'm sure he can pay homage to. So prison was not a deal breaker. But in the end, the public defender clearly was, it was like a table decision. My personal opinion, this was the equivalent of how unions work with companies or employers. At the end of the day, everybody sits down at the table and there's just one big compromise and everybody leaves happy. And whatever fallout there may be, it's like, oh, well, the big chiefs have decided. So at the end of the day, there was a decision from the state's attorney, which is who brought charges. It wasn't about me. It was the people,
right,
versus Oliver. So they decided to say that they wanted 20 years. And well, I thought that was just outrageous. I'm like, oh, my God, he has a file so thick from his medical record file that I had copies of everything and even had it organized from the year. So every year, every intervention, every process was there. I'm like, oh my God, he has a file thicker than three people. Clearly somebody has to see that this is related to a mental illness, and how can this be? And I was just devastated. So
Charisse, we're gonna take a break, and when we come back, we will find out what happened to Oliver. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Charisse, 20 years is what they wanted for your son. What ultimately happened?
Ultimately, the judge, which was so fair and reasonable, compromised after my victim impact statement and me insisting that the public defender call the psychiatrist that said those infamous words. You would be worse off if you stopped taking this than if you've never taken it.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you must call him as a witness, because this is where the problem lies. This was 2 months earlier that he was told this. And so she did. So what she did was, the public defender did, was mitigate the trial or the sentencing with his mental health, rather than making that be the focus.
Okay.
So she did nothing for the whole year, and that was that. So what the judge ended up doing was he got 12 years. So the judge said he took what the state's attorney's office said and pretty much cut it in half. And with the year that he had already served, it comes down to like 8.5 years or something, because it's a felony. It's a class X felony, so he doesn't get to have that break that a non-felony conviction would have came with. So we thought that that was just unreal as well. In our mind, and like again, we're not in the legal system, we felt he would get something like 6 years, but it was double that. So we had no choice but to deal. And then I got to see him every month when I would go to court, and that was always pleasurable. And the bailiff, because you always go into the same courtroom, so you have the same judge, the same bailiff. And it would just, I would just make an outing of it. And like my two best friends would go with me every month. And we would just make a special day of it where we'd go and we'd have breakfast afterwards. Rather than treating it like a tragedy, we mm-hmm. took it like this is, we're in the journey, we're in the process of whatever Oliver needs to get better. We're going to do this with dignity. So the bailiff used to threaten to put us out because, of course, I'm like trying to talk to Oliver while we're sitting up in the court. You're not supposed to do that. And then when they would take a break, he would say, why don't you come sit closer and pretend that you're not talking to him because you clearly talked to him throughout the whole. So he would give me, you know, that chance because that was all we could have in contact. Because when he got sentenced to the prison he was at, I couldn't go there. I couldn't see him there either. So the good news is we are a small family, but we are a very close family. So his older brother, Robert, who since Oliver's been incarcerated, has gotten married, has a baby boy of his own, manages to go see his brother at least once every couple of months because he's a very busy guy. He's a teacher, he's a track coach, and he's a husband and a father, so it's not easy for him to go more than that, and I wish it could be, but it's not. And the dad now lives in Houston, so he comes up once or twice a year, and he goes to see him then. And I get to talk to Oliver every week, sometimes two and three times a week, because we do have phone privileges, so he calls me, and we talk anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour at least once a week. So we've maintained the lines of communication and the love of mother and son that's never, never suffered.
You know, there are so many, I mean, talk about gaps in the system. I mean, clearly you've identified so many places where intervention needed to happen and continues to need to happen. I mean, just the intersect between mental illness and criminal behavior, and how do you mm-hmm. really, how do you evaluate this? How do you treat these folks? What about medication? While he was incarcerated, was he able to take his medication?
Never. According to my son, well, the first prison that he was in, which I it's crazy for me to say because I don't know that there's ever a thing called a good prison, but the first prison that he went to, which I don't think he had any choice in, actually was very workable. It's just so far, for my son would have to drive 4 hours one way. It was like we're in Illinois, and this prison is really close to St. Louis. So it was a nice little drive. And it seemed like he was in such a good place. It took him a minute. I mean, he suffered with an ulcer when he first got there. I think he had literally worried himself crazy because this was all foreign to him, too. And but he got along. You know, he's an easygoing kid, so it was not hard for him to make friends and do what he needed to do. That was my first concern was, now can you meet with a prison doctor? Is there a psychiatrist there? He's like, nope, because in Illinois, there's only one prison that is considered a therapeutic prison, and that's actually where he is now, which is closer to where we live. And that's the reality of our prison system. There's no medication, there's no psychiatry, there's no therapy, there is nothing. But on the website, it boasts that it's a therapeutic prison. And that was why he went there, because he's like, I want to be able to start getting some help so when I get out, whatever I have to go through, it won't be a culture shock. And he's like, Mom, there's nothing here.
That, you know, once again, I mean, it's breathtaking. How much is not available. I mean, the whole thing is just sort of blows one's mind in so many different ways. I mean, the judge, the system, if you will, has the information that he has got to be on this medication, and yet he is not on this medication and conceivably won't be on the medication until he gets out of jail.
Right. And because now he will be 29 when he gets out. He gets out August of 2017 will be his eligibility for parole. It would have technically been November, but the new governor that we have, because governors rule prisons, he changed some formulas because the prisons are also overcrowded. So he's doing some unique things that shortening all sentences wherever possible. And even though Oliver is considered a violent criminal based on what happened, he has had absolutely no incidents since he's been incarcerated. This kid never had a fight in school. I mean, he doesn't have any history of violence. This was totally the one time. Of course, it's the biggie. It's the biggest time ever. For most people, never go through anything this major. But for him, this was it. So this is setting the tone for his conditions of parole, we are assuming, because he's not coming out with a drug conviction or burglary conviction. No, this is attempted murder.
So given that he is not on medication and he is bipolar by diagnosis, and the doctor has already said that it's critical that he take medication, he could in fact have a break between now and when he's scheduled to come out.
Or more than likely when he comes out, because the correlation of him being confined, we believe, has contributed to the fact he doesn't have any choices.
Okay.
When you can't get up to go somewhere, then, you know, you can go through your day and you can learn how to adjust accordingly. When he gets out, whatever the conditions are, I'm assuming that he will probably go into maybe a halfway house for a period of time, or an ankle bracelet, security process where he can only go so far or only for so many hours. Whatever those conditions are, that I guess would be them trying to see how he will orientate back. But once again, even with those things in place, it still is them opening the door and saying, bye, see you, good luck, without any systems in place for him. But then my son gave me another revelation, because I'm like on a soapbox with him, like, this is a travesty, blah, blah, blah. You have a mental health illness. And he let me go through it. And he says, Mom, 90% of people in prison all have mental health illnesses. And that's a reality. That's a wake-up call that people don't really understand. The prisons are filled with that. And no matter what the crime was that led you to be in prison, 90% of the time, which that's not a research statistic, I'm just going by what he said, but I tend to believe it. So let's just say more than half of the time, it is someone with some kind of underlying mental illness that did a crime, and the solution is you go to prison, but you're not getting any help for what caused you to do the crime that you did in the first place.
You know, I certainly agree with you, and there certainly is so much more work that needs to be done with respect to who is actually in prison. And the fact that prison, I mean, we all know that at this point you go to prison and you come out a better criminal. You don't go to prison and come out reformed, which in theory is what it's supposed to be about. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. It seems to be more about punishment than anything. And in your son's case, and in the case of many people with mental illnesses, actually, it's not only your son who's being punished, but it's the society that he will reenter that's being punished.
Exactly. And more importantly, when people in, when, especially youth, when you go in, you just remember, he went in at 19. So he's lost a decade of his life. So he's going to come out at 29, so he'll be entering into another area, another era that brings on its own challenges, none of which he would have had any preparation for because he missed the 20s. But at least in my son's case, where you can only affect change by what you do and what you're able to do. So being just one little person, my goal was to make sure that when my child got out, he was getting out to something. He was coming home to a family, and he's coming home to a legacy to help him not to go back. Now, clearly, that's, again, the choice would be his. If he decides that he wants to contribute to the statistics of recidivism and end up back, then that won't be anything that I'm going to hold my head down for, because I've done above and beyond in preparation for him to come home to something. So he's not the kid that's getting out at 29 and everybody's turning their back and it's like, well, I don't know where you're going to go. I don't know what you're going to do because you're not coming here. Well, I have a set of circumstances that are a little unique because I was almost killed by him. So I can truthfully say, well, you don't need to come back here. And I can, and I'm making sure that that happens in terms of not to live. Because, number one, you will be 29. And I didn't have a whole lot of control over what you choose to do at 19. I feel like I have absolutely none at 29. So you're going to have to do the man thing, and that's figure out where you need to be and what you need to do. But we're here to help you. So we're not closing doors. I mean, like my oldest son said, Mom, I don't think it would be a good idea for him to come there. I live in the same house, in the same neighborhood that this happened. I think about my neighbors. That was horrific for my neighbors.
Of course.
It was horrific. So I wouldn't want to put them through seeing him every day and having, because I live in a neighborhood where nobody, it's not a transient neighborhood. It's so funny, my neighbor to the left of me is an elderly lady. As a matter of fact, I've lived here for 8 years. No, 10. I've lived here for 10. And her husband died in the process of me living here. And she's very, very elderly. And she's over there. And she walked the driveway a few years ago to come and sit out on the patio and talk to me. And she was saying that she wanted to make sure she got to know me, because she never had a chance to get to know the other lady that lived here that got hurt by her son.
Interesting.
I tried everything, Pam, to tell her I was that lady. She was like, no, 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 but it was because I don't look like I've been hurt. You know, I look okay.
Right.
So she was assuming that, I think she thinks that I died. And she just is not connecting all of the dots. So I kept saying, no, that was me. She's like, oh, no, no, no. It was another lady. She had a son, and it was a big to-do. But no, it wasn't you. And I was like, okay, I just stopped trying to convince her.
Right.
So wherever the system is going to end, our goal is, as a family, is to be able to help him start a new life. And we are all kind of just making it up as we go.
As you are making it up as you go, you also came up with an application to help folks. Talk to us about My app.
My app is the brainchild of Oliver. And it speaks again to the heart of the human being. Remember when I said in part one that I look at kids throughout their youth, when they become older, they are people. So the fact that he committed a horrific crime, as a human being, he has the biggest heart. So for the last 2 years, maybe 2.5 years, he started on insisting that I look into something that we could develop, he and I together, to help families not have to be torn apart like our family was. And he's like, Mom, I don't know what it is, but I'm not in a position to do a whole lot, but I've been having these visions, I've been having these dreams, and I just know we got to come up with something. And his first thought was a skin patch, because and that makes sense. You know, you look at what it is that you could have had that could have helped you from doing what you did, and maybe that would have could help others. So he felt if instead of insisting that he took medicine and assuming that he was going to take it, even though it was so deadly of medicine that if you stopped taking it, you could be worse off, well, rather than putting a 19-year-old through that, what if they had applied a skin patch that would have had a monitoring system that could alert the doctor when you are no longer taking your medicine? Now, it's a whole lot involved to that, and I did do a lot of research, contacted a lot of people, spoke with tremendous amount of lawyers, spoke to a lot of psychologists and pharmacists over a year, and I got a lot of energy and support, but I kept hitting the wall with, we can't say that there's a product that can be produced that would actually do what you wanted to do. It's like what we were talking about just kept falling a little short of being able to be something that a person, like a chemical engineer, could actually create and it be a doable thing.
Okay.
So the other part to that is when you get a chance to, when you start doing heavy-duty research, you run into heavy-duty people, and that elevates your thinking. So I spoke with some professors at University of Chicago, and they just broke it down. They said, Charisse, first of all, what makes you think that society wants this? And, of course, I've got all the data and statistics to support it. They said, oh, we know. We all know about Sandy Hook, Columbine, the theater shootings, Virginia Tech. We all know about that. And those are tragedies above and beyond. But what makes you think that the world would want this? It's a total confinement of one's civil liberties. And I had never looked at it like that.
Interesting.
And from there, I decided that that was not the best place for my energies, because Lord knows, as you know, I have a lot of other stuff going on. So I said to Oliver, in like a conclusion statement, we can't do this. It's too much. It's bigger than us. It requires deeper pockets than what we have. And I just think we need to table this until we could meet maybe an investor or a benefactor somewhere down the road. And I will keep all my documents. So he's like, well, Mom, I appreciate you doing this so much, but we can table that. But I just think with this being a digital age that we live in, there's got to be something that we can do. And that's where my app, the Mental Health Intervention App, was officially born from that thought.
Charisse, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear all about my app.
Okay.
Charisse, tell us about My App. What is an application? What does it do? What is it intended to do?
All right. The Mental Health Intervention App was created to become a tool to be used to communicate on-the-spot feelings, whatever's changing in your life, to be able to communicate that to your health care provider or your caregiver, if that's the person you feel more comfortable with, who can then communicate whatever's going on to your provider. And the provider would be able to make on-the-go adjustments. For example, okay, I want to see you in the office tomorrow instead of next week. Or I think you need to go to the ER, or you sound a little unbalanced, or you don't need to do anything, just maybe go home, lie down, and let me know how you feel in an hour. But the purpose for the app, because we know everybody texts nowadays, and email, I don't think will ever go away, but it's not always as convenient if you're having some kind of emergency or a psychotic incident. You may not so clearly be able to communicate through email or even locate the person's email address. So having an app where you are the client and you're signed in as the client, you have a screen that shows all of your providers, because some people have 3 and 4 different healthcare professionals that see them. You know, you may have a psychiatrist, a therapist, a coach, and they're all working with you or whatever your disorder is. So if you need to communicate how you feel that day, because it's a daily mood chart, then you select your mood. The next screen for the client would be a journal. You have the option of speaking what you want to say, or you can type what it is you want to say. For example, if you select the mood frustrated, that just tells the provider that you're frustrated. The journal will provide you with an opportunity to elaborate. I'm frustrated because I can't get this new prescription filled, and with my insurance card, they're not accepting it, and the prescription is $300. I don't have it. I'm just really feeling frustrated. I'm very upset. Well, what a provider would look at is not so much the details of your journal, but your pattern of speech. And that will provide them with the data that they would need to make a decision. So when a client submits the mood chart and the journal, then the provider side of the app, that mood chart turns into a graph. And that enables the provider to have the data. If the provider sees that over a period of maybe, let's say, 3 weeks, that you're frustrated or you're angry and you're talking about hurting yourself in your journal, well, the provider can print that out and say, I think you need to be in the hospital. I think we need to readjust your medicine. And you as the client can say, no, I don't agree. I think everything is fine. Well, the provider would have data to support, well, no, this is what you're saying. If a provider finds himself or herself having to go to court over an issue, obviously data is what drives every decision. So it wouldn't be the provider saying, I think that, you know, this person said that they've been frustrated for 3 weeks. You would be able to show that. So it gives everybody the tool by which to make adjustments in between office visits. Everyone that's seeing a mental health professional, it's usually on a 30-day basis. But we all know the reality of life can change within a day or within an hour. So to be able to communicate changes in between visits and sessions, we felt that the app would definitely be a useful tool.
So let me understand. I'm the client, and let's say I'm bipolar. And so now I have this app. So I've listed now all of my providers. So I've got a psychiatrist, I've got a therapist, and I've got my medical doctor. So they're
okay,
all
listed. Okay, let me just interject this.
Okay.
You're not listing them. You are going to each provider and say, hey, I found this app that I would like to use. I'm going to need you to download the app, because the provider would have to download the app in order to communicate with the client. And there's no cost involved. So it's like, and it's on Android and Apple, so usually you don't have people saying, no, I can't do it, it won't work for me. And either way, provider can say, I want to use the app to all of his or her clients, they would have to download the app. So I just wanted to throw that in, because sometimes people feel like you can just somehow list people, but no, they have to be, they have to sign into and download the app themselves.
So all the communication is through the app?
Well, yes, all the communication is through the app up to the point that, you know, one or the other feels like it needs to, you know, take it to the next level.
Gotcha.
But yeah, you can communicate everything through the app.
So I sign up and I've convinced my three providers to all sign up for this app, and I sort of chart my mood for maybe a week. And
mm-hmm.
then do I push a button and it goes to all of my providers? Do I choose my provider that it goes to? What happens with my mood
yes.
chart?
The intention of the mood chart is to be a daily communication.
Okay.
And we know that different users are going to make it work for them, and that's perfectly fine. But when you decide, let's say if you do want to use the scenario that you just mentioned, which I think is quite reasonable, that they would check themselves over a period of a week, and then they would say, okay, I'm going to send my chart in, and they decide whatever mood it is, angry, energetic, whatever. And they can choose, because their providers would all show up in the provider screen because they would have downloaded the app. So they can choose which provider they choose to send the mood chart and the journal to. And then they hit, they press the send button, and then they'll receive an automated message saying, your message has been sent. At the same time, your three providers will receive a notification of you having sent your mood chart and journal. And we know, once again, people are going to make this app work for what's most convenient for them. And depending on their clientele, what it can also be used for other situations other than mental health, which we could talk about in a little bit. But sometimes I can visualize some doctors using a staff member to say, hey, I want you to monitor this notification, because they're seeing patients on a revolving door schedule most of the time, so they're not necessarily going to be looking at an app or recognizing a notification and being able to respond. But you can give an office manager the responsibility, hey, when you see this notification, check out and see what's going on. And for that reason, we made sure that the app is interacted with its website, because if the provider, whoever it is, office manager, therapist, doctor, if they choose to look at it and deal with it on a website as opposed to a mobile app, they can. So the same function that happens with the mobile app can happen with the website, because the providers are given a separate login component to the website, which is necessary if they choose to print out the mood graphs and the journals.
I see.
So that way, that's how they will be able to access it. They log into the website with their mobile app credentials, and then they can view it and respond to the client all from the website if they choose to.
Interesting. And is this app HIPAA compliant?
Yes, it is HIPAA compliant, because the app is not diagnosing or discussing any specific illness. It is strictly a communication of mood, chart, and journal. So there's no opportunity for a doctor to say, well, based on what you've described, I think you have whatever. That
okay.
would not be anything that would be part of the intent of the app. So it's a communication of a client's mood and their pattern of speech, which is the journal, either speaking it or writing it.
So it sounds like this is a more organized, structured, if you will, sort of email format, but it's more structured, and Is that a fair statement?
Yes, because number one, with email, it takes a little bit more time to get locate an email, compose an email, send it, and there's no guarantee that there'll be a notification that there is an email waiting. You know, many people don't have, especially those in the very busy world where they're, like I said, the scenario of seeing a patient every 15 to 20 minutes, there's no time to check an email.
Right.
So that, you know, that could be an email waiting that won't get looked at until the next, to that night or the next morning. Whereas you get a notification on an app, you can quickly just press the app, the icon on your phone, and the notification, the whatever the client has said, it comes right up.
So I could see this working really well when folks are trying out new medication, not just psychotropic medication, but any kind of medication. Are you having side effects? You know, you've just gotten home from the hospital. I mean, I could see it really working in a lot of different arenas, medical and otherwise, but certainly medical.
Absolutely. And originally it was marketed medically because, again, this was Oliver's quest to have something that we could have, if we had had this app, this is what, how we feel we could have changed the eventual circumstances that we lived through. I would have been using the app to contact the doctor to say he's erratic, his behavior is risque, you know, he's doing this, he's doing that. And the doctor would have the data over time, and hopefully that would have been, you know, you can go to the extreme of sending police to say, you're like a well-being check, you're not safe, we got this data to show that you're not being safe, your mom is not safe, we're going to take you in. That's the extreme purpose for the app, but it's legal. A police can be discharged to anyone's location by a doctor for the purpose of wellness. So if I had had the app, it wouldn't have been about Oliver contacting the doctor. I would have been contacting the doctor.
So then I start to think about HIPAA again, which are the rules that govern patient privacy and how it can be utilized and how it needs to be protected. So from a HIPAA perspective, it seems to me that Oliver would have had to give the doctor permission to receive information from you in order for the doctor to be able to respond.
Well, keep in mind, the information that I would be given would not be based on a medical disorder. It would be based on his mood. It would be based on what's happening, what am I witnessing, what is happening, because I'm not able to provide a diagnosis. So the doctor would not be looking for anything I say to say, oh, well, it has something to do with his bipolar disorder. The mood chart in the journal would be saying specifically what Oliver's behavior has been over the past day, 2 days, 3 days. And that would be the doctor's knowledge of what's going on, that he wouldn't communicate through the app of anything medically. He would be able to advise me on what I should do, which could be, one, see if you can bring him in. Two, do you think you can get him in? If not, we'll send the police. That is not the doctor and I communicating regarding Oliver's bipolar disorder, if that makes sense.
You know, I just as a clinician myself, I would think that I would want to have some written authorization from Oliver that allowed me to communicate with you and to receive. You know, I don't need anything necessarily.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That does make sense.
Yeah, that's what I would want. Because I think that sort of makes it more transparent, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I think more protective of the clinician as well as the client, and would lay out what kinds of situations in which the clinician might be able to directly speak to the client? Because I'm not even sure if, as a clinician, even if you sent me the information about Oliver's behavior, if I could say anything, I could talk to Oliver, but I don't know if I could talk to you. So I would want some sort of authorization that would really clear that all up.
That totally makes sense. Like, for example, at that point, Oliver was an adult. At 19, it's considered an adult. When you look at patients who are battling schizophrenia, I totally agree with that, having that be established before there can be any communication, because it is those kinds of diagnoses like schizophrenia where the person may not be able to communicate through a mood chart. They would need somebody else to do it for them because mm-hmm. their behavior is so erratic and so risque at that point. But thinking about it from another lens would be if you had a minor child who has a mental health disorder where you are legally, you know, able to right. communicate because you are in charge, that also is an optimal use, and which has also had the desire for people with that situation for the minor children has had us to put forth some other conditions and steps within the app. So it's now marketed not just for healthcare professionals, but for any professional who is navigating between systems such as the Department of Children and Family Services or the judicial system where there's a minor involved and things can happen. Like before Oliver turned 19, we were in a lot of situations where that app could have helped me to communicate better.
Sure.
But I totally agree with you, and I think that I will look at developing that. I'll look at my get with my team, and we will see the best way to implement that, because I do think that that's huge. That's the power of connecting with people.
Absolutely. And speaking of connecting, I'd like for you to let folks have your website. We're pretty much out of time today, but I'm pretty yeah. sure that folks will want to continue to learn about more about the app as well as the other things you're doing.
All right. Well, the website to learn more about the app is mentalhealthintervention.org. And there's my phone number, my email address, any questions or any additional support that either a client or provider would need, feel free to contact me and I respond within 24 hours. And any other information of any other products, I'm not going to give you like multiple websites. That one website, mentalhealthintervention.org, you can locate me and other products that I have and anything you want. You only need to go to that one website, and then
wonderful.
There's links there to provide you with whatever you need.
Excellent. Wonderful. Charisse Beach, thank you so much for spending time with us twice now to share your story and your wisdom and your experiences and expose gaps that we need to be aware of and we need to continue to think about and work very hard to close. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pam, for having me.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications are the producer for Mind Talk, and a special thank you to Antonio Slade, who provided important production assistance for this program. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. The best place, however, to go is myndtalk.org. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. Take care.